Thank you, James. I'm Greg. Good afternoon. I'd like to thank the organisers for the invitation to be here. And I'm going to try and talk you through probably a really complex issue: invasives, climate change, and insects. Sorry. Where are we coming from with this presentation? What we want to do is try and get to the final point. There's a need for a holistic understanding, particularly in invasion ecology, of what's going on, what are the mechanisms, what are the processes? Because without that, we won't be able to understand how invasion ecology and climate change are going to interact. And that synergy between the two is really exciting. It can be really devastating as well. Given the economic and environmental damage of invasives and the role of insect pests in that, that's where we're coming from this. And complexity is something to be embraced. It's not the enemy, unlike Romeo, but it's something that needs to be embraced and to be considered. So we're going to try and talk through that in this presentation. So biotic impacts of climate change. I'm assuming we're all quite comfortable with climate change. Taking a very complex subject, trying to cover it in one slide, what's it going to do? It's going to affect growth rate, development, phenology, distribution. It's going to affect the entire ecology of a species. It's going to affect its physiology, its distribution, its movement around the globe. The point I really want to make is the degree of the response, the biotic response to climate change, is generally species specific. That's what the literature is kind of saying. When you get to the point of trying to generalize, it's really difficult because different species respond differently. Each species has got its own climatic boundaries. That's something I want to bear in mind as we go through this. And of course, insect herbivores are central. Just going back to an old theme of mine, the green blob, a plant. If you look at that, you've got insects right in the center controlling what's going on, the foliar feeding insects, the above and below ground insects. You've got this bunch of stuff going on with the communitores and the decomposition cycle. But insects are right in the center. This is a very simple component community. Scale it up, but and up and up and up to larger communities, and insects are still in the center. They're, as we've already heard, they are essential to many of our ecosystems and ecosystem services. When you throw in climate, it suddenly gets very interesting. So the insect herbivore is in the center again. The impact of climate on the plant, the host plant, and on the natural enemy. You've got impacts on functional numerical responses. You've got impacts on how the plant grows, its ecology, its physiology. Those are indirect effects on the insect herbivore. There's also direct impacts of climate change on the insect itself. And a whole suite of traits are affected directly and indirectly. And let's not forget the community and the decomposition or the biogeochemical cycling. They're affected by climate. They then impact on the host plants and on the natural enemies and on the insect herbivores. And it gets horribly complex very quickly, but we need to try and understand it to be predictive. Just one example of climate change having, or climate having, an impact on a pest. This is a horticultural pest, Chromatomyces gentiae. Three different water regimes in a very simple laboratory experiment. Two parameters measured: density, number of mines per leaf, and then pupal weight of those mines which made it to pupa. And 10 milliliters applied every other day, 20 milliliters and 30 milliliters. 10 milliliters is equivalent to a severe drought. 30 milliliters is equivalent to overwatering in the field. 20 milliliters is standard field conditions for this species. And not only do you get more mines per leaf under droughted conditions, their fecundity, the pupal weight, is increased as well. So you can have dramatic population effects with climate. So this is just one example, just to throw in some data to show you that climate and insect population dynamics is linked. So what about insect herbivores as invasives? They're really important. We've heard they can change ecosystem structure and function. They're pests, full stop. And they're important as targets or the agents in biocontrol. And I want to consider these as we go through. So how are they invaders? Well, economic damage due to agriculture, horticulture, forestry. Beneficial insects introduced as pollinators, introduced as biocontrol agents. But also natural invasion can interact with pollinators and disrupt natural pollination. This is something going on in the UK at the minute with our bumblebees. And can disrupt natural control of herbivores. Let's not forget, they're parasites and vectors of diseases. Diseases is one area where invasion ecology is going to be really important. We need to get a handle on diseases. They're household pests. But it's this interactions with native species that I'm particularly interested in as well. So a whole host of things that insects as invaders are affecting. What about the pathway? An invasion pathway. It's a bit like arriving in the US. You arrive in the immigration hall and you feel really good because you've arrived, but you haven't actually done anything. You haven't got through past the immigration officer at that stage. So you've arrived and you then get recruited. You get called up to the desk, but at that point you can go extinct by being expelled just because you're not smiling nicely or whatever. So what I'm saying is that you arrive, just because you're arriving in a new area does not mean that you're an invasive. You need to recruit, and you can go extinct at that stage. It's quite likely you might go extinct at that stage because there's a lot of pressure on you, biotic, abiotic, and extreme events, just for a few. If you get past recruitment, you establish. You've got your feet firmly planted in the ground. You've established yourself within the new environment. You're there. But again, you can go extinct because of these pressures. But if you can also, if you follow the red line, you can also go through local redistribution and become another arriver. You could start spreading out at this stage. That's where you can become an arriver again in another environment. As you establish, you grow. The chance of going extinct as you grow is quite low, although it's still possible. But as you're going through your growth, you can also spread out and redistribute yourself and become an invader or an arriver in a new environment. And then you get to the invasion bit right at the end. You grow and you reach some critical population size or biomass. Chances of going extinct at this stage is quite low. And you can disperse locally or into a new habitat. That's when you're beginning to invade your new habitat. And then you get to the dispersal migration stage when you've reached your critical population size. You're off, you're dispersing yourself. When you disperse, you can go extinct because you may not find a new habitat. The new habitat may not be suitable, may not have the correct host plants if you're an insect herbivore. You can successfully invade a new habitat and go all the way back to being an arriver. So this is the invasion pathway that we need to consider. And each step is critical to success to be an invader. Arrival, well, intentional release by control agents, escape from protected environments, very, very common in Europe, aerial dispersal, and transport by humans. We've heard a lot about post-World War II and the increase in transportation around the globe in the last 50, 60, 70 years. Human transportation is very important. There's great anecdotes you can give. The field site I've worked at, you can see a line of plants from the gate to the field site where seeds are being distributed along researchers' boots, and it's an invasive plant is coming in. And transport by humans is central to this. Once you've arrived, what about climate? How do you establish? Climate is critical. The climate envelope, the boundary for your growth, your establishment is critical. Approximately 50% of your ability to establish is determined by climatic conditions, the right temperature, the right precipitation regime, the right relative humidity. You've got this whole host of other things, diseases, parasitoids, predators, and the amorphous other. And you get to the establishment stage. How are you going to be successful? Well, as an insect herbivore, there's this whole list of traits which could be important, and the literature suggests are important, but nobody's put them all together. Polyphagous, obviously. Scattergun egg laying seems to be important. Association with humans, I don't fully understand it, but that's meant to be important as well. Longevity, how do you reproduce? What's your diapause mode? Are you multivoltine, univoltine, bivoltine? What's your reproductive rate? What about abiotic tolerance limits? All of these traits are important for establishment, not altogether, but if there was a superorganism which had the lot, then it'd probably be an awesome invader. And then you get to the invasion stage. You've established, you've recruited, you've arrived, recruited, established, now let's invade. In terms of insect herbivores, what about, what traits are important for invasion? We consider diet breadth, phenological plasticity, and diapoles. In terms of diet breadth, it appears, would suggest that the larger the number of plants you feed on, it's more that you're able to feed on, it's more likely you'll find a suitable host in your new environment. Seems quite obvious. You'll also do better under climate change, because if you're forced to shunt around and redistribute due to climate change, you're gonna find something you can feed on. But of course, there is a slight problem. If you're a taxonomic generalist, then you're likely to be a nutrient specialist. This is work from the 70s and 80s and 90s, where it appears that many insect herbivores are looking for a particular nutrient or carbon-nitrogen-water ratio within their host plants. And if you're a generalist, you can feed on a whole host of different host plants. You've got the luxury of being able to go around and tap in and find that particular carbon-nitrogen ratio to maximise your reproductive development. This is work that Southwood, McNeil, Lawton and people like that did in the 70s and 80s. So you might be able to feed on a whole host of whole range of plant species, but you may not be able to have a maximal reproductive rate because the physiology of the plants is changing due to climate change. It gets horribly complex very quickly. Host switching can occur. That's something I want to come back to at the end. You can't guarantee that you'll be able to you won't be able to stay on the same host plant. You may not be able to. Climate may force you apart. The plant may change faster than you can track, or more likely, you may change faster than the plant can track. What about phenology? If you've got a really close phenological coupling, you're dependent on a particular stage of leaf development for your first instar, then you're likely to be badly affected. I mean, winter moth and oak is a classic example there. But if you've got extreme phenology, you might be able to exploit niches which have opened up due to climate. And extinctions and population crashes of natives are going to provide opportunities. So phenological plasticity, which is quite an amorphous subject, is something which could be crucial. If you're a winter moth and you cannot hit that window of development of the leaf, the oak leaf, then you're not going to be able to get beyond your first instar. And that's going to be affected by climate change. And diapoles, we kind of thought that diapoles was going to be central. And if you had a fixed diapoles, then you're not going to do very well as an invader or under climate change. You need to be flexible with your diapole strategy. We kind of thought this was a really good trait to look at, and the meta-analysis we did suggested that diapoles would be one of those subjects which should be a strong trait. It seems as though it varies, and there's a lot of incorrect classification, so we've had to rethink diapoles a bit. But I still come back to the point that if you've got a fixed diapoles, certain number of days below a threshold temperature, for example, you may not be able to affect that. And if you need 10 days below -2 centigrade and the climate warms, you may go into diapoles, you may never come out. So we still think it's, the data's not there, but we still think it's an interesting suggestion. Niches are everything. Increased level of disturbance means there's gonna be more niches. Climate change is definitely going to increase the number of the level of disturbance. Of course, there's increases, the changes in resource levels, not only plant chemistry, but plant height and architecture. With increased CO2, plants might be bigger. There's a longer growing season. If you're multivoltine, you might be able to exploit that quite nicely. And there's unused resources because native insects might have left and there's these open niches for you to invade. And extreme events, which is one of the strongest predictions of climate change, is just going to provide windows of opportunity. And average climate is might be unsuitable and fatal conditions may occur. I just want to get on to species interactions and decoupling just to finish. I want to make that second point, actually. But with biocontrol, you may not be able to assume climate matching in the future. That may need to be thought about. You can build community matrices. I'm not going to go into the details, but you've got plants, you've got generous herbivores, specialist herbivores, predators and below ground systems going on, and you've got the interactions between them. These can lead to the development of conceptual frameworks. So if you're a leaver from an environment, you're leaving due to climate change, you might be a dominant, a subdominant, or a rare, and the whole host of effects, such as if you're a keystone or if a particular functional type, if there's redundancy of the functional type, and leading to changes within the community. So you can, by looking at community matrices, you can then start underpinning conceptual frameworks. Frameworks can be parameterized. We know information like true dominance, marginal dominance, and rarity, so we can actually get to that information. So if you just look at one example to finish with, dominant plant, P1, a lesser plant, P2, might be an agricultural system. Thicker arrows are stronger interactions between species. And you've got SH, specialist herbivores, GH, generous herbivores, C, commutators. And so what happens if you take away the dominant? If you can't grow your crop in that area anymore, you lose all these strong interactions. That leads to a community. It might be a transient community, but a community where top-down control of the second plant, it might be a weed, is increased. So the abundance or the performance of that plant is decreased because of increased top-down control. It also leaves a large open niche for invasion by a plant, or you might get other herbivores or species coming in at the higher trophic levels, disrupting those interactions. That's it. So you can get it, what happens if you invade, where you recruit, you establish you're an alien, new environment. You can invade to become a dominant. If you become a dominant, you critically affect your ecosystem and ecosystem services within it. You can get community collapsing and restructuring going on. You can go extinct or you can be rare as an alien. That's quite common. That's not going to affect your community at all. The exciting stuff goes on in the middle. Subdominance. Are you a new functional type? Are you a keystone species? Are you another representative of the existing functional type? And all of these then impact on how community dynamics develop in the future. And this is these conceptual frameworks, I think, can actually help us in understanding the invasion under climate change concept. So I want to say invasions will be unpredictable. Synergy between invasive species and climate change is still unknown. There are several groups working on it. How are the two going to act together? Not a case of studying them separately, but together. And what's the combined impact of the two on a community? And decoupling, or the loss of species interactions, is, we would argue, central to understanding these systems. Thank you. That's it, James.